Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
State Department veteran Peter Van Buren returns to the Peter B. Collins podcast.
How does a bastard, orphan, son of a whore and a Scotsman, dropped in the middle of a forgotten spot in the Caribbean by Providence, impoverished and squalor, grow up to be a hero and a scholar?
The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter. By 14, they placed him in charge of a trading charter.
And every day while
that's a piece of the opening theme of the musical Hamilton, where it references the founding father without a father and the Caribbean island where he was born. I think I can claim to be one of the few Americans who's actually been to Nevis, to the birthplace of Alexander Hamilton. Peter Van Buren used the Hamilton theme to describe what's going on in the State Department today, a place where he worked for 24 years. Peter, great to have you back on the show.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Peter.
And the Hamilton theme is something I need to make one other comment about before I let you talk about how it refers to the new State Department. But I'm actually going to see the Hamilton musical tonight, May 4th, and it's courtesy of one of my listeners, Billy Cook, who is a longtime supporter of the Peter B. Collins podcast, decided to give me a pair of tickets for my birthday. And he sent me a lovely note along with it, thanking me for all the podcasts that I've done. He is a relentless booster of the podcast on Facebook. He oversubscribes to support my work. And now he's given me free tickets to Hamilton, so I got to thank my benefactor, Billy Cook.
First of all, happy birthday. And second of all, are you still looking for the plus one on that?
Oh, no. Kathy was really excited when she heard about this. And I've actually got a date tonight.
Yeah, I've seen it. I've seen it a couple of times. It's not bad.
Yeah. So why did the idea of Hamilton occur to you as you wrote a piece that was published by Reuters on April 21st about the current operations at Foggy Bottom?
Well, obviously, I'm being a little cheeky in my use of Hamilton, but what I was struck by when I was thinking about how to characterize the State Department is that it's often being portrayed now in the media as the victim of Trumpism and the victim of its lazy leader, Rex Tillerson.
Excuse me, we call him Rexon Tillerson. We like to remind people where he came from.
Inside the State Department, they call him T-Rex.
Yeah.
So nonetheless, and I think there's plenty of truth. I mean, we'll circle back to the fact that obviously the Trump administration has little need for the State Department, and Rex Tillerson has little engagement with the State Department. But the idea would be that most articles simply paint state as a victim of mm-hmm. all these things, and argument can be made. When I was listening in Hamilton, I was struck by those lines about working a lot harder, being a lot smarter, becoming a self-starter. And I thought back to my own 24 years in the State Department and what state has always suffered from. And it's going to perhaps prove to be a fatal blow at this point, is this lack of initiative, a lack of sort of being the person who stands up and clears his throat and said, but sir, there is another way we may want to look at that. State Department has always been a passive organization. I think it grows out of its East Coast elite Ivy League roots. It's kowtowing to power, its hierarchical structures. And when you had a powerful person as Secretary of State, and when there's been some powerful people there historically over the years, and for example, Hillary Clinton, though I am no fan of her, certainly was in control of the organization. The State Department does whatever it does as well as it does it, because it, I want to
challenge that.
I'm giving credit where it's due here. There's enough caveats in there. I think people know. But the idea would be that when you take away that leader, there's nothing left there. The State Department has no idea how to adapt, to overcome, to seize the initiative, to stand up for itself. And you can look at the military, for example. One of the big problems with the military is that it doesn't sit still well. And if you don't keep the soldiers busy, whether that's a couple of grunts on the ground or the entire, U.S. military machine worldwide, if you don't keep them busy, they find things to do. And it's not always a good thing. Mm-hmm. But it's not always a bad thing either. The State Department is passive. It waits. It waits to be told what to do, and it waits to have powerful leaders take control of it. And if that doesn't happen, then it just simply sits on its hands and waits. What's going on now, when you've got the Trump administration, who really sees no value in the State Department and perhaps in diplomacy in general, is that becomes fatal for the organization and potentially quite deadly for us as a country. You need someone to step up, and that stepping up does not seem to be coming from state. And so in hopes of doing my civic duty and inspiring them, I offered up the lyrics from Hamilton.
And if I may quote from your Reuters article, state is an extremely vertically oriented bureaucracy with layers below the secretary that wait for bits of policy to fall so as to inform them of what their own opinions are, kind of trickle-down approach. Mm-hmm. One academic referred to this as necklace government, a head and a body missing an active two-way connection. State is indeed so vertical in mindset that employees have traditionally referred to the secretary by a location on the physical top of the building, the seventh floor, as in the seventh floor needs that memo sent up or trouble will come down.
It is quite literally a bureaucracy in its physical expression. Now, of course, bureaucracies do work this way, and the federal government in general tends to have, senior people talking to junior people. But what the State Department not only lacks but actively tries to avoid is any kind of creative tension between the middle, the top, the middle, and the bottom, if you will. First, as the necklace image tries to conjure up, there is no middle. There is no sort of loyal opposition, band of rivals, all those kind of good words in the middle management that tries to interface aggressively between the lower rank and file and the upper political appointee management. To create some kind of creative tension that hopefully would yield up better policy. Instead, the middle management, to the extent that it exists, really is just there to funnel stuff downward and take the product back up if it, in fact, agrees. And if it doesn't agree, State Department uses what's called the clearance process to make sure that everything gets nice and gray. How it works is this. We all famously know after the Clinton emails that officially everything that's sent out from Washington is supposedly signed by the Secretary of State. All of those cables and emails and everything all said Clinton at the bottom of them. We saw that with the WikiLeaks release as well. Well, obviously, the Secretary of State isn't typing all those things. But in theory, the Secretary represents the final approver. So it works this way. I'm at the bottom, and word comes down that Secretary Tillerson is going to Saudi Arabia, which they just announced, I guess. And so what are the issues in Saudi Arabia today? So somebody at the bottom of the pile who spends his whole pathetic life doing this says, well, here are the top five issues. And then that goes to my boss. And my boss says, no, 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 you can't say number four. Trump loves that guy. So get rid of that one. Give us another one because we have to have five. And that process will continue until the document reaches towards the Secretary of State, where his or previously her people will further refine this so that by the time it reaches the secretary, it absolutely agrees with what he or she has already said previously. Mm-hmm. That is not a recipe for good policymaking. It's a good recipe for happy bureaucracies, I guess. But what happens is that when there is no one on the top calling for anything, the people below Tillerson in the State Department really are just sitting around, quite literally sitting around the cafeteria saying, well, if anybody needs me, I'm right here.
Now, Peter, are these observations at least in part informed by the period of time after they yanked your security clearance and removed you from any active assignments and you became a hall walker at the State Department? Is this how you were able to observe how, you know, the Near East Department was off on a field trip and that the, you know, the South Pole Bureau
yes and no.
Was all at the Smithsonian that day? I mean, go ahead.
I suspect, Peter, if you walked into Foggy Bottom and grabbed the first person that's been there more than a week and administered the truth serum to him or her, you would get basically the same story because it is inherently the way the State Department is set up to work. It's not what I'm saying to you now is hopefully revelatory in the sense that your audience is not composed entirely of State Department employees. But if, in fact, you were doing the Peter B. Collins podcast for the State Department, people would be yawning at this point because it's like, yeah, of course, that's like saying, you know, water is wet. This is exactly how things are structured. So I'm afraid it's not as insightful as it hopefully sounds, because it's simply the way business is done.
All right, so we've got T-Rex or Rexon or whatever people want to call
like
him.
Rexon, yeah.
And he has been dealt a budget cut of 30%. Congress probably won't sustain that, but that's what was enunciated from the Bannon White House.
Yeah.
And he has left many positions unfilled. I think 200 desks as of last week remain vacant. These are at the middle level and upper positions. Mm-hmm. And so do you actually see this as a good thing where there's going to be at least some evaluation before they just fill those slots and continue to stamp things and, you know, pass and filter information upward as you described?
See, it could be a good thing, but I doubt that it will be. Any organization has fat that can be cut. Any organization can profit from some streamlining. And the State Department clearly has had too many layers added without enough layers being removed along the way. What's going to happen, I'm afraid, at the State Department is not a thoughtful examination of where these cuts might be made, but rather something kind of clumsy and crude. And that is on state. In other words, if the State Department sits there passively, as I'm sure it will, and waits for Tillerson to make decisions or make non-decisions, essentially leave things empty until they just kind of shrivel up and go away, then the cuts are going to occur more or less randomly or in the wrong places. What the State Department should be doing is rising up and saying, we know you're going to make cuts, rather than doing the bureaucratic thing, which is instantly to resist all cuts. Let's take some initiative here. Let's admit that Office X doesn't have any purpose. And let's propose getting rid of that one and at the same time explain why Office A, B, and C are critical and those cuts should not take place right there. Absent that process, I suspect that what Tillerson is going to do is simply allow jobs to pend indefinitely, to allow civil servants to retire and leave openings that will never be filled. And so the process will not be well thought out or thought out at all, simply subject to randomness. And the bureaucracy in the State Department will sit back and let that happen. And 4 years from now, you're going to have an organization that looks like Swiss cheese, where the holes are in not necessarily the right places or the wrong places. There, nobody really paid attention to where those holes were in the first place.
So I understand this perspective. My problem is that to date, we have seen true disarray and no clear enunciation of foreign policy positions by this new administration. And Trump has freelanced many of his contacts with foreign leaders in ways that cut out the State Department, leave them scrambling to read the Post to find out, you know, what actually happened on that phone call. And, you know, my concern is that, Trump is so inexperienced and amateurish that even given your description of the work product that is developed by the State Department, it's probably better than the stuff that he pulls from Fox and Friends and maybe one of his billionaire cronies who called and said, "Hey, Don, I got a problem in you know, country Y." So my concern is that not that we need to protect a bureaucracy or the kind of trickle-down process that you described, but that we have people with significant agendas that, in my view, conflict with the stated American policies and throw us into confusion, disarray, and leave our allies with jaws gaping.
You know, I don't disagree with you, but the counter to that would be, well, let's take a look at the last couple of decades of American foreign policy and, you know, see how the State Department has done. And it's given us the collapse of the Soviet Union, which turned out to be a huge mismanaged mess on the part of the State Department. It's gotten us the utter lack of progress and certainly a lot of regress in Israeli-Palestinian affairs. It's gotten us the giant clusterfuck of a mess across the Middle East in regards to terrorism. It's gotten us the failures of the reconstruction in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's gotten us episodes in Libya. I mean, it's a long, long list of the last couple of decades where supposedly, you know, the best people in the State Department, fully funded, given all the tools that they need, including, you know, superstars like Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And yet, look at the results. So we're kind of asking the open-ended question of, well, if that's the best they could do with all the tools in place, is it going to be worse?
All right, but Jared Kushner? I don't even need to complete that sentence.
Well, I mean, you put up Jared Kushner, and I counter with the Bush neocons.
Yeah.
And me. And I don't know if you're familiar with a guy named Brett McGurk.
Yes.
But, you know, so I counter with those guys. And
let's define that McGurk was assigned by Obama and perhaps even earlier, essentially as the coordinator of the war on the Islamic State.
That's correct. And McGurk has been deeply involved in Iraq policy from 2003 forward. He's played significant roles under three administrations now. So the point being is not to defend Jared Kushner, which is not a defensible position, but the idea is to say that before we announce that the world is going to collapse around us, let's just take a look and see what we've accomplished under, you know, what we're claiming are good circumstances. You know, the best president ever with the bestest secretary of state ever and the smartest peoples in charge ever. And look what we got. I don't like the results. Mm-hmm. And those were, like I said, under the good circumstances. So I don't know how much worse it'll get. I mean, I guess we can always say, well, nuclear Armageddon. And yeah, that'll disappoint us all. But I don't realize that we're going to reach nuclear Armageddon. I suspect it's going to be the same clumsy fumbling that we've been doing as foreign policy over the last 20 years or so. It's just going to look worse. We need a word, and you're a clever guy, Peter. What would be a new word we're going to invent that basically says something that has been a problem all along, but we're only noticing it now because of Trump and or reacting to it now because of Trump?
I'm going to have to work on that, Peter.
Yeah, I mean, for example, this idea of embracing dictators, you know, where that Trump seems to say nice things about dictators. Well, America has loved dictators throughout its history. We've never found a Middle Eastern despot we didn't like. We've never found a strong man in Central and South America that wasn't our best buddy. There's nothing new going on here, but it somehow acquires a different spin now that it's Trump. I don't know. Let's call it Donald's Law for now. How about that?
All right. Okay. Now, I do see your point, and Glenn Greenwald offered a similar analysis recently, just that, you know, we have an unbroken string of love affairs with dictators. Some presidents have, you know, acknowledged a human rights issue, starting with Jimmy Carter, who tried to imbue foreign policy with at least a leg in the foundation of human rights. And, you know, Tillerson just yesterday, in his second talk with State Department employees, was, you know, paying lip service to human rights while saying we're never going to demand any certain type of behavior from people who we consider to be our allies. And, you know, I do think that that can be seen as real politic and a recognition of the true history of American policies. But it also is disappointing that we don't even offer the aspiration of trying to set some standard for human rights as an example.
See, this is where I'm back to Donald's Law again, because while I think Americans react to things like Tillerson's statement, oh my God, we're abandoning human rights as a cornerstone of our foreign policy. I'd like to ask some of the families of drone victims, some of the families whose loved ones have been in Guantanamo all these years, all the people whose lives have been destroyed in Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, because of American foreign policy, gee, maybe even some Vietnamese, what they think about America's commitment to human rights as a cornerstone of our foreign policy. And I'll submit that what most Americans believe about themselves is such deeply embedded bullshit that what Tillerson says or doesn't say really only is something we can chat about here in the United States. I think most of the rest of the world has already figured out who we are. We just may not know it ourselves.
I'm hearing you, Peter. I'm hearing you.
Am I clear enough here, Peter? I'm afraid I'm being subtle.
Now, have you looked into the origins of any relationship between Donald Trump and Rex Tillerson? Because from what I've been able to glean, the two had never met. And yet, you know, he surfaced as a candidate in the transition and was named by Trump, apparently, after they met a single time. And, you know, this is different from some of his cronies like Mnuchin and Wilbur Ross and these other people, Betsy DeVos, who populate his cabinet, who have been at least in part of his coterie in the past. So where did Tillerson come from, and who ever imagined that we'd have an oil man with no political or diplomatic experience be our Secretary of State?
Right. There's the oil men without experience are supposed to be in the Bush White House. So, yes, you're right. It does represent a dramatic change. You know, it's a good question, though. Who is this guy, Tillerson, and where did he come from? I suspect that the answer is something along the lines of Trump couldn't get anybody to really do the job because they knew the State Department was going to be left to the side. So no one with any political aspirations really wanted the job. And the ideologues...
Rudy, I think Rudy wanted it. Rudy Giuliani. And also Mike Flynn volunteered to be Secretary of State.
Now, Flynn, Rudy, I think everybody understood he's going to be under indictment one way or the other. Flynn is a better, I'll have to grant you that one. But I think the idea was that the real ideologues who Trump wanted there are going to have to wait. He knew he was going to have a hard time. Tillerson was sort of a, in a Trumpian way, sort of a bland candidate. And I think Trump wanted someone to just be in a kind of a caretaker position while he disassembles, you know, most of the State Department. I don't think he sees a need to have one. And I think that there was a lot of resentment over how State took Clinton's side so strongly with the emails. I think State was on the chopping block when Trump got elected. And I don't think Tillerson is going to be there for the 4 years. Mm-hmm. I think he's a kind of a placeholder that will either be filled by yet another placeholder if Trump has no use, or at the point where the State Department is properly reconfigured, you could easily imagine someone like Nikki Haley sliding over there ahead of her presidential run.
And what about John Bolton? He certainly aspires to it, and he was on a short list during the transition.
Yeah, I mean, I think Bolton has way too much baggage with him. He's hated inside the State Department, which would have been a good reason to appoint him from Trump's point of view, I suspect.
Right. I mean, his whole model is the wrecking crew, and Bolton probably has the greatest cred as somebody who would dismantle an organization like State.
Yeah. I think the problem with Bolton would have been that he would have also wanted to be Secretary of State. He would have dismantled State Department. He would have been very good at. But at the same time, he would have wanted to be out there negotiating things and making official visits and, you know, doing foreign policy. He's got a lot of his own ideas about how that's all supposed to work. The thing about Tillerson is that he seems to be truly without interest or ambition. He seems to be bored by this entire thing. It kind of reminds me of like being asked to take someone to I had this one situation, which I'm afraid you'll have to wait for my memoirs, where I was asked to take someone, a young woman, on a date because she was the visiting daughter of my boss. And it's like, ugh, do I not want to do this? And the last thing I'm going to do is you know, treat this as in a date-like way. This is just something we're going to get through. And Tillerson, I get that impression. It's just like, I don't want to be here. I don't want to do this. This is awkward. And I have no interest in it.
Mm-hmm. But now, to what extent do you think that his relationship with Putin, the deal that was suspended because of sanctions worth $500 billion or more, and take that and run with a little bit on your views on the whole Trump-Russia scandal or non-scandal?
I'm finding it difficult to see that every decision Donald Trump makes, has made, and will make is somehow directly tied to Russia. Exxon, pick any other large American company that's not a defense company, and they've got complicated dealings going on with Russia, if not 10 other countries. It's business. If you're an energy company like Exxon, you are in Russia. You're involved in Russia in some way. It's that simple. And the same thing for IBM or any other large corporation. So the idea that a CEO of a large American corporation had dealings with Russia doesn't really, really surprise me. I think what we're ignoring in all this, because we're so headstrong into Donald Trump is the Manchurian candidate and all that other good stuff, is the extent to which Russian money has corrupted the world. It's all over the United States in our system. I live here in New York, and Russian, quote, businessmen, unquote, purchasing real estate for cash is sort of a joke. I mean, it's sort of a standard trope that comedians will haul out when the audience isn't responding. You know, they'll make the joke about how slow the subway is, and then the joke about how, you know, the Russians and the Chinese just bought up all the apartments in their building for cash. the amount of Russian money that was released in the endless corruption in the 80s and 90s there is staggering. The fact that Trump vacuumed up a lot of it is not very surprising at all. The fact that Trump's now president is I guess, what's surprising. But I suspect that if you peel back some layers on any other large American corporation, certainly anybody that has relations in Europe or deals with real estate, the amount of Russian money that's out there is staggering. The amount of influence that they purchase is staggering. Whether it's all traceable back to Putin and his, you know, international mastermind criminal enterprises or not, I think is exaggerated. But you're going to have a hard time finding people who aren't tainted by this foreign money, given how much flows around the world and how global these businesses are becoming. You got a choice. You know, you're ending up with people with no experience who have been in the business world, or you've got people who have spent their entire lives in government and are tainted from that angle. Pure bloods, they're harder and harder to find these days.
Well, and I agree with you. I think that the hysteria over Trump-Russia has been highly exaggerated. I do think that there are interesting and newsworthy issues. For example, the investigation that Who, What, Why published a few weeks ago about this guy Felix Sater, who you know has an apartment at Trump Tower. He is a convicted felon. And he ran a bunch of pump and dump stock scams and then was basically an envoy for Trump. And Trump now says, Felix Sater, I don't think I can remember him. And those don't necessarily go to the claims that, you know, Russia manipulated our election in favor of Trump. And I remain skeptical of the central claims about the hacking. And just this week, Jim Comey is back before the Senate Judiciary Committee, you know, flatly stating that, that Russia hacked the DNC. And we have seen no public evidence of that. And you, I believe, have signed on to the VIPS letters, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, challenging and based on the assessments by Bill Binney and others who worked at the NSA, that if there was, in fact, a hack that Russia was responsible for, that NSA would be able to trace that and show us. And so I'm very uncomfortable with the house of cards and the you know, various conspiracy theories that are being trotted out centrally by Rachel Maddow and her colleagues at MSNBC.
You know, there's something very, very, very fundamentally wrong when you say that our democracy is so fragile that a handful of emails changed everything. If that's true, the problem lies much, much deeper than quote-unquote Russian hackers. The problem lies with the fragility of our system. And I think that part of this discussion gets lost. In terms of looking at, well, why don't we know what happened yet? I think that's another significant question. If, in fact, the Russians hacked our system in some way, let's just leave it as open as possible, it seems to me that the vaunted technical capabilities of the United States should be very clearly imposed on that and tell us what happened. And the thing is, with all this kind of forensic hacking and things like that, you know, it's not, it doesn't have to be real time. You can go backwards. That's one of the things the NSA prides itself on. That's one of the reasons why they collect all this information and warehouse it, is that if and when it's necessary, you can kind of wind things backwards and say, okay, here are the records of what happened electronically on that day. Let's now decide that it's worth looking back into. So where is all this evidence? We it should just be there. We shouldn't have to have hearings and have contradictory discussions. Just, Jim Comey, if you've got it, put it on the freaking table. Let's see it. And get Bill Nye to come on TV and explain to us, you know, what all the ones and zeros means, so that everybody in America can come to the conclusion that X happened. And then figure out what to do after that.
And Peter, this is one of my, you know, 10,000-foot level observations. And that is, we've seen all of this this rhetoric and all of these claims, and we know from the Shattered book that the day after the election loss, that John Podesta got everybody on the same page with the message point that it's Russia's fault. But Comey himself acknowledged in his most recent Capitol Hill testimony that he was pushed over the edge last July after Bill Clinton hopped on the Attorney General Loretta Lynch's plane for a little chat at the Phoenix airport. And that you know, for whatever reason, offended Comey, and he felt he needed to go public and end speculation about the Hillary Clinton email investigation. I think that Comey's role and then, you know, the resumption of the investigation and then, you know, it was almost immediately called off again in the days before the election. I think that that deserves much deeper investigation. And the senators, at least in the public hearings, are willing to let him bat those questions away.
I would have loved to have kind of stuck with Comey a little bit on that business about Bill Clinton getting on the plane with Attorney General Lynch. And, you know, exactly what concerned you there, Jim? Anything come out of that meeting? Any memos? Any phone calls to you? Any, you know, you can't just kind of let that flop out there and then walk away from it. The same thing comes with these questions about, if you recall, all during the campaign, there were these issues about, well, there was no classified material transmitted through unclassified means and various forms of that. But basically, the Clinton campaign denied that they did any of that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Comey just casually mentioned yesterday that, yeah, there were all these classified emails on Anthony Weiner's laptop. Didn't we just say basically that the Clinton campaign lied over the course of a year and a half about this? And I'm almost certain that if you, without a proper clearance, Peter, had classified material on your laptop, that it would be of note, that the FBI would probably have a few questions for you about that. I certainly know that when I was falsely accused of disseminating classified material by the State Department, the word intent never came up in our discussion. It was, we believe you did this, and the fact that you disclosed material, they said, it wasn't, turned out to be not true, was all that mattered. There's no half pregnant. You either protect classified information or you don't. The only difference that intent may play is in the punishment phase, where obviously something that's accidental and incidental and non-consequential is punished less than something that's, you know, purposeful. But otherwise, there's no escape clause for intent, and yet that was what Comey was allowed to say without question the other day. Yeah. It's a bizarre, bizarre situation, and the more that we watch of it, and particularly the more that people who have even the smallest knowledge of how these things work, the more you just wonder.
Indeed. Peter, the last thing I just wanted to get your comments on is the April 4th incident in Khan Shukun, Syria, the release of a chemical agent, and the unproven but very, how can I put it, consistent and vociferous claims from a variety of people, including the Trump White House, that they know that the Syrian government was responsible. And this, of course, takes us back to Ghouta in 2013 and John Kerry, who repeatedly said, we know the Syrians did it, and forensic investigations really challenged that. And there's no conclusive evidence that the Assad government was responsible for that. It was used, again, treated as fact, as a basis to conclude that, oh, yeah, well, they must have done it again in Khan Shukun. And Ted Postol, the professor emeritus from MIT, published a very detailed breakdown and debunking of the White House claims. And the most you know, powerful is the images of these rescuers who were trying to help the alleged victims of a sarin attack, who were able to walk around without any protective gear, and they appeared unaffected by it. And so there are serious questions, but there are only a handful of skeptics. The media has piled on. And again, this unproven set of assertions is treated as fact, and it was the basis for a military assault that was approved over chocolate cake by Donald Trump.
I am privileged to be a member of an organization called VIPS, which is a number of retired intelligence and military professionals, including some people that your listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with: Bill Binney, John Kiriakou, Tom Drake. Some very, very brilliant people, people who made their whole careers studying things like chemical weapons and signals intercepts and things like that. And I have learned from them an extraordinary amount of information. And while I myself am not an expert on those fields, I have had the opportunity to talk with them, to question them, to hear their explanations. And there's not a one who believes that these chemical weapons were used by Assad. I come from a different perspective. That's the technical side of it. I come from a different perspective, and that's diplomacy. And one of the cardinal rules in diplomacy is that people act, nations act, out of their own self-interests. Sometimes you got to work hard to figure out what that self-interest might be, but self-destruction is rarely self-interest. And so the question would be, why would Assad use chemical weapons the time and the place that he did? He had just gotten a free pass from Donald Trump. Trump had just made statements prior to this gas, that basically the United States was not going to pursue regime change. And boom, the next thing Assad does is to poke the United States in the eye in a way that historically he would have known would have provoked a response. It's one of those, it just doesn't make sense. And simply saying, well, it doesn't make sense, or he's just a crazy, brutal dictator, you can't trust him, there, they act irrationally, you know, that simply doesn't hold up. The Assad family has somehow irrationally held on to power since the 1960s in Syria. Parenthetically, the same way that the Kim family has held power for 70 years in North Korea. These are not folks who act irrationally. These are folks who have acted quite coldly in their own self-interest. And simply poking the United States in the eye like this after you've achieved diplomatic victory makes no sense. So you add up the technical information, it makes no sense. You add up the strategic and the diplomatic information, it makes no sense. Dropping sarin gas kind of indiscriminately like this is not a particularly useful military technique. It tends to dissipate fairly quickly. It just makes no sense. And at the end of it, how many times you say it makes no sense, you're left with the conclusion that, in fact, it makes no sense. You then start to pursue the Occam's razor thing. What does make sense? And what makes sense is that people who felt the United States' commitment to this war was starting to wane decided to get involved and figure, what's the easiest way to trigger the Americans? I know. Say the words, weapons of mass destruction. We're still trying to, you know, work that hangover off since 2003. And so as soon as you mention chemical weapons, boom. The Americans get all riled up on it. It becomes an apple pie issue. And that's clearly what happened. Now, which group other than Assad, you know, actually deployed the weapons? That you get into a whole, there's a whole room full of actors who mm-hmm. could have a reason to have done it. But I don't think it's particularly even important to sort it out which one it was or which of them it was, because what happened was clearly just a little tweak to make sure America stayed involved in this war, and it was obviously very successful.
And I don't know if you've seen it, but this week, as if to pile on to a very successful propaganda launch already, CNN, I think it was Aaron Burnett, interviewed a 7-year-old girl who appeared to be getting cues from her mother, and it was basically this appeal for the U.S. to come in and take out the Assad government. And I thought it was highly irresponsible of CNN to spend so much time in a live interview with a 7-year-old. And it reminded me of the Kuwaiti incubator false meme that I actually fell for. Hill and Knowlton scheduled an interview with me. I was doing a local radio show in San Francisco in 93. They brought us this. She was a 12-year-old who we were told had witnessed Iraqi soldiers dumping Kuwaiti babies' preemies out of an incubator in a hospital in Kuwait City.
Yeah.
And I did challenge this woman, this girl, when I interviewed her. But the power of the propaganda wave and its embrace by the corporate mainstream media was something that couldn't be overcome. And we now know that that was a completely concocted PR project. And that's what I saw when I saw this 7-year-old girl on CNN the other day.
You know, but they're not even trying very hard anymore. These things are so transparent. You look at the sarin gas attack in Tokyo. This was in 1995 when a cult in Tokyo released sarin gas in the Tokyo subway system. Now, if we know one thing about the Tokyo subway system, it's a crowded place. And it's a confined space. It has limited air recirculation. And thankfully, only a handful of people actually died. And that has a lot to do with how hard it really is to effectively deploy these chemical weapons. Meanwhile, in Syria, these things are supposedly dropped willy-nilly out of helicopters into the open air, subject to the wind, the breeze, and all the random elements, and look at the horrible damage that gets done. Nothing makes sense about this. And to simply say, well, this doesn't make sense, but he's a crazy dictator, and this doesn't make sense, but he's a crazy dictator. I mean, eventually that line gets worn out, and you're forced to look for other solutions and other answers. And when you pair it with 7-year-olds coming on, being coached, I mean, there's this young Syrian refugee girl who supposedly has a Twitter account, documentaries being made about the white helmets who only save the good guys in Syria, of course. It all starts to add up in a very predictable way. Very little propaganda is as clever as we try to give it credit for. Most of it is the same old techniques recycled over and over again. You go for the heartstrings, you bring out the kids, good news is it works almost every time.
Yeah. Peter, I always enjoy talking with you. Thanks for joining me today, and we will continue this conversation at a future date.
I look forward to it. Thank you again.
My thanks to Peter Van Buren for his insider perspective on the State Department. I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.